You okay, Rina? You seem stressed. What's going on?
Do you ever feel that parenting a disabled child is chaos, like absolute paperwork chaos? There's just so much admin on top of caring for your kids. It's like I'm my freaking daughter's PA.
Ah, yes. You should try the new Hibi app.
An app?
Not just any app, it's Disabled Parenting Mega PA organization. So you can schedule appointments, have reminders for your medication, have all of their medical notes and letters in just one place.
Hang on, spell this out to me again.
Hibi, Hibi. It's a disabled parenting organization app. I wish I'd had it when B was younger. It gives me a sense of control over, well, the uncontrollable.
Sounds intriguing. Who doesn't want to organize disabled parenting chaos one notification at a time?
Haha, yes, it's my new sidekick. Sidekicking the shit out of disabled parenting organization.
That's the least catchy strapline I've ever heard, Lauren.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. They won't want it. But if you, like Rena and I, want to give it a go, you can download Hibi for free on the App Store now. So today's episode, we talked with Suzanne McManus. It was a lovely conversation all about her own experience of being a parent to autistic kids. She told us a lot about the PDA profile of autism and how she's changed her parenting style. I really enjoyed talking to her.
Oh, me too, me too. And I love hearing about what she's doing away from parenting her kids because I think it's so important to acknowledge that SEN parents should be able to get back into the workplace. And we offer so much and it's so difficult. So it's really nice to see somebody at such a big broadcasting house like the BBC trying to help and do something with that.
Yeah, it's excellent. I saw the assembly that she talks about in the episode. We hadn't seen it at the time because I think it was before it came out when we recorded. It's just absolutely brilliant. So Suzanne commissioned it in the first place.
So she's commissioned a show whereby young people with neurodiversities interview a celebrity and ask any damn question that they want.
Exactly. Yeah, it's brilliant. I love that she's trying to get that representation out there. It's just really refreshing because it's all these young people with various disabilities, but a lot of them with learning disabilities. And I think we just don't see people on television with learning disabilities in that way, or well, we don't see them very often, and certainly not in the context of the assembly, where it wasn't like there was judgment and a lens on those individuals. All the judgment in the show, The Assembly, was around the celebrity.
As it should be.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a really interesting conversation, and she's fabulous.
Yeah, enjoy.
Wake me up, loud as clouds, all my love for you. You're a dreamer, I am too. It's fucking normal, we would rule the world.
This is the Fucking Normal Podcast. The cheers, tears, and Friday night beers of parenting disabled children.
I'm Rena.
And I'm Lauren.
And we're both mothers to daughters with special needs. Parenting a disabled child can often feel difficult to navigate. If this is you, you're not alone. We're here to share unique parenting stories and chat about the things that we've learnt and are still learning.
Prepare to sometimes laugh, sometimes cry, but hopefully leave with a shot of optimism in your arm. And don't forget, we are talking from a parent's perspective. We would never presume to talk on behalf of a disabled child or adult. So expect bad language and, quite frankly, some brutal honesty.
Because really, what the fuck is normal anyway?
Wake me up, loud as clouds, all my love for you.
Suzanne McManus is mother to two boys, Joseph, 8, and Frankie, 7, and is the sole female in her, as she puts it, neuro-spicy household. Her partner was diagnosed with ADHD a few years ago, and both her kids are autistic and have ADHD too. Her eldest, Joseph, has the PDA profile of autism, where PDA stands for pathological demand avoidance. A PDA profile typically includes well-understood autism traits, but in addition, PDAers have a profound need for control, which is often anxiety related, and are driven to avoid everyday demands. PDA children tend to not respond well to conventional parenting, teaching, or support approaches. So it's fair to say Suzanne has had to do a lot of unlearning and relearning.
Professionally, Suzanne works as a commissioning editor with the BBC in entertainment. As if that wasn't busy enough, Suzanne is also on a mission to encourage employers, starting with the BBC, to ring-fence more part-time roles for people who've had to leave full-time work to care for family members with disabilities. Yes, please. Amazing. I'm so pleased you're doing that. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you. Great to be here.
Oh, it's so great to talk to you. So let's kind of step back a bit to start with. Tell us about your boys, and in particular, Joseph, your eldest. Why did you seek a diagnosis for Joseph? How did it all start?
Well, I'd actually been trying to conceive for, best part of 20 years. So I had got to that point where, I'd stopped for a few years and then I'd come back to it. And then I remember sort of getting to the point that, like, my marriage had actually broken up and I was with a new partner who's, my current partner and dad to my boys. And I remember saying to my friends, I don't want to be that woman who gets drunk together and just cries about the baby she's lost. So I thought, we'll give it one last go. And that last go ended up in Joseph and Frankie. And I mean, we were both, well over the other side of 40, a lot of science involved. And at the time, I remember Stu, my partner, he was so, he was scared anyway. I think he's an only child. His parents had separated and he was kind of scared. He didn't have any kind of a dad role model that he identified with. So, but one of the things he used to say was, he'd recently been diagnosed with ADHD himself at 40. And I think, we'd both be ashamed to think now that at the time he felt that there was something he was ashamed of or something that to be ashamed of. There weren't, there wasn't that much positive information around about ADHD. And so he sometimes would say to me, what if I pass this on? What if, we have a baby and they've got ADHD? And I was like, well, fine. Because at that point I was like, if I could just get pregnant, the rest would be fine.
Yeah, of course.
And then, and then I was like, oh, sure, we'll know what to do because, we'll have your understanding and we'll be brilliant parents. And, so, we didn't think much about it beyond that. And then we had Joseph and I just remember all of that, like everybody going, oh my God, your dreams have come true. Isn't that fantastic? And I think a lot of particularly women who've been through baby loss and infertility recognize that thing that, you're supposed to think that this is the most amazing thing in the world. And everybody thinks, oh, you're so brilliant. You're so brave. You're so like, you've made it happen. And it's like, no, I've got this baby that never stops crying and I don't know what to do and I feel so alone. And it's actually, apart from all those hormones that rush through our bodies, after having a child, it is such a confusing time. So this beautiful boy that we had, in his first few months, he started crying at about 4 weeks old, and he just didn't stop. It felt like he didn't stop.
Oh God.
And, looking back now, there are all the things that I can recognize and I identify with, but I just didn't know at the time. So as a baby, I live in Stoke Newington and it's a very kind of, baby friendly environment. So there'd be baby yoga and there'd be baby singing and all these kind of groups and stuff. And he would just bawl all the way through the baby yoga and the baby singing. And the only way he would stop crying was when I breastfed him. And I remember, we'd go to the pub for Sunday lunch because I'd be so broken and we'd be like, I need some food. And he'd cry and the pub was, when I say, absolutely just nonstop. And of course, now I can realize that that was noise. It was the sound. It was the cacophony. The pub that we used to go to was one of these kind of oldie wooden floors, wooden ceiling, wooden walls. So it was just total noise. The baby singing, total noise. And once he was old enough to run away, that's what he would do. He would just run away. He'd just make for the doors. And by the time he was old enough to run away, I had Frankie, because there's 18 months between them, which is nuts enough anyway. So I'd be carrying Frankie in a pampoose, just like running after this child who just constantly ran away from everything that we tried to involve him in. So there should have been clues there, looking back.
Did you feel that gut instinct that something isn't?
I felt he's got ADHD, because ADHD was the thing I knew, the thing to grab onto. And so at 6 months old, because of this, you know, exhaustion and crying, and I remember I noted down that Joseph breastfed 27 times in 24 hours. And again, Jesus. Looking back, you know, he was doing that for sensitive reasons, probably, or for safety, not necessarily because he was hungry, but, you know, I was exhausted. And so I made an appointment. Stu and I went to see Dr. Tanya Byron, who's a fantastic clinical psychologist. And I had worked with her in the noughties. I commissioned a series called House of Tiny Tearaways with Tanya and Claudia Winkleman.
Oh, I think I remember that show.
Yeah, it was like, it still gets repeated. And so I kind of trusted Tanya. And at that point, if she'd said, oh, just hang him out the window and let him dangle for a bit, he'll be fine, I probably would have done that. So Tanya kind of took one look at me and looked at him and were like, look, he's just this absolutely perfect child. You've gone through all of this stuff to have a baby and you're carrying all this anxiety. And understandably, you know, she just went, you've got to chill, put some boundaries in, do a little bit of, you know, just trying to settle him, get yourself some sleep. And she said, I think he's got ADHD. And she said, look, those pathways haven't even formed yet. You know, just relax, get yourself some routines. So, you know, we did that. And to a certain extent, that worked. And then Frankie came along. And by that point, I kind of had the sense with Joseph that he was a law unto his own. He was always going to do his thing. Started playgroup, which is like kind of part-time school hours nursery when he was 2 and 3 months. And I remember taking him in there with Frankie in the baby carrier. It was gorgeous environment. And the key workers were like, shall we go and all sit on the carpet and have a little story time? And all the other children followed, all the 2 and 3 year olds. And Joseph just stomped around going, no. And I was like, oh, he's strong-willed. But I was just so mortified. And nothing would make him feel like he wanted to join in if it wasn't on his terms. But he was such a funny, active, bright, clownish kind of a little boy. I didn't think beyond he may have ADHD, which isn't diagnosed until a child is 6. I didn't think anything else.
Did you feel judged as a parent at that
very
time?
Much.
Then?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's just like, I remember him like running away. There was a little open air swimming pool in Clissold Park. It was a baby's toddler pool. We were using this pool and I stopped to change Frankie's nappy. So he was lying on the grass with, you know, just changing this kind of stinky nappy. And Joseph decided at that point that he was going to strip off his clothes. He was about 1.5 to 2. And just with his stick and his hat, he just decided he was going to run naked across the whole park out onto the street. So I had no choice but to, like, in a swimsuit, pick up this child without a nappy, this like sort of 3-4 month old baby, and chase after the other naked child across the park out onto the street. So, you know, there was, yeah, I got. Well, I say I got used to judgment. I don't think any of us ever really do. We're not as good as we'd like to think.
No, definitely not. Did you have, because obviously now they've been diagnosed with autism, did you have any experience with autism, or was autism ever kind of like in the back of your mind?
Funny enough, my first experience with autism was when I was very young in Ireland. So I grew up in Dublin, in the suburbs of Dublin. And it was quite a close community. And the family who lived a couple of doors down from us had an autistic child who would have been about 4 or 5. And he had 2 younger sibling girls. And I used to babysit for them. I was about 14 at the time. And I just loved them. And Darrow, it was this fabulous little boy. He was nonverbal. He was very locked in. I remember his mom, Sheila, always said, you know, if I left him in the kitchen with all the food in the cupboards, he would starve because he would never be able to feed himself. And I had such a lovely bond with him. I adored him and his sisters. And so when I got the opportunity, I was able to work in my school holidays in the school where Darrow went. And this was, I mean, I say school, it was a group of parents had set this up in a hall with a nun who basically set up the Irish Society for Autistic Children and was the first advocate in Ireland for autistic young people and adults. And through her drive and passion, she had, you know, set up this little school. She later went on to set up a skill centre for training autistic young people. And that at that time, people didn't know about autism. And it was around the time that Rain Man came out. So when they did know, it was a case of, you know, I remember kids going, well, you're working with artistic children. What, did they draw very well or something? And it was, I thought it was Rain Man or it was, you know, something that they just didn't understand. So this core group of parents and their children were really the sort of outliers. This was in the 1980s in Ireland. They set up the Irish Society for Autistic Children. So I loved to volunteer with them in the school holidays. And then when I left school, I went to study radio and television production. And at the end of the first year, we had to make a documentary and a drama piece and a radio piece. And for my documentary, I decided to make it. I asked Dara's family, could I make it about them and Dara? And they were really happy to do that. And it ended up winning this award in Ireland for schools and TV programmes. And it got shown on RTE, which was the national, like the BBC in Ireland. And for years, the Irish Society for Autistic Children used that to raise awareness and to fundraise.
Wow.
It's only in my teens. I think I was about 17 or 18. And so that was the weird thing.
That's so weird, isn't it?
Right at the beginning of my career, that was the thing that kind of, I suppose, had influenced me to want to explore it. So yeah, that it did come up. I didn't, because again, like many people later on, I thought about autism in a linear way rather than, as we now know, you know, a spectrum is more like a round disc with strengths and challenges. And so when Joseph and Frankie were babies, I remember saying to Stu, I read something and I was like, God, do you think he's autistic? And we both were like, no, because we're like, he makes eye contact. He responds, you know, so all of those cliches we were looking for because we didn't know any other. So I never thought about autism really until we lived in Switzerland for a couple of years. So my partner got a job in Lausanne and so we went, which was idyllic. We lived on a vineyard overlooking Lake Geneva. And I remember thinking, people like us don't say, we're moving to Switzerland. It just felt so, you know, privileged.
Sounds glorious.
Yeah, it was. Literally.
But the other side of that was, you know, that thing that we all learned a few months later in the pandemic, that, you know, when you're isolated from friends and family and support and all of those things, like, you know, those baby groups that I'd known and that those connections, it's very lonely. And then at that point, Joseph was almost four. He was about to start school and we'd taken him away from everything we knew. So he was reacting to that in what I saw as, you know, terrible behavior, but which was this huge amount of anxiety. His world had been turned upside down. Plus we put him into school in the village school where they spoke French. And this poor kid is like, what?
Oh my gosh.
And so at that point, I kind of remember going on Parent Network Facebook group in Lausanne or in around the area saying, does anybody know a doctor that deals with neurodiversity? And we found a place called Libellule in Lausanne, which were fantastic, and went there with the two children fighting and crawling all over each other and biting us. And the lead psychologist said, have you ever thought they might be gifted? And we just went, I just laughed because it was like, no, look at us. You know, we have no indication of that. And she said, because gifted children often present as difficult from birth. And I thought, wow, that resonates. And I actually kind of burst into tears because I suppose for the first time I thought, I'm just underestimating these people instead of me thinking, you know, they're just crazy and I can't cope. It was, wow, there is so much going on here that we don't understand.
And were you seeking a diagnosis for like both children at the same time then, or was it with your eldest? And then
no, it was just for Joseph, our eldest. So in you know, truthfully, I think with Frankie, our eye was so off the ball with Joseph because Joseph was so high needs that we took, Frankie felt like the, you know, the kind of unicorn baby that was quiet.
Mm.
So he had different presentations because obviously he also is autistic. So did he cry as much?
No, he was much quieter. I think by necessity, because of chasing naked Joseph around everywhere, I baby wore Frankie a lot more. So he was a lot closer to me. He was very quiet. He was very like kind of self-contained. From being about one, he would love to, you know, just build little things, do jigsaws, one or two, do Lego. And so he felt easier. And so I didn't really think about it. And again, it was only when he started at the same playgroup, the manager of the playgroup said, we have a little difficulty understanding him, but that's, you know, I'm sure that'll be fine. Or we can work with a speech and language therapist if needs be. And I remember feeling actually a little bit affronted going, it's fine. But as he got older, I found that we understood Frankie better than other people did. And that became, you know, again, in Switzerland, where we were in a French-speaking environment, that for him became so frustrating because people couldn't understand him in English. They only spoke to him in French. And Frankie's such a really loving, intense, peace-loving child that when he went to playgroup and we started to hear about him pushing other children or, you know, getting annoyed if they came close to him.
Frustration.
Yeah, it was only then that I started to put two and two together with Frankie that it was communication issues. Literally communication because everybody's speaking a different language, but also he was interpreting other children as a threat.
Yeah.
So with Frankie, I think it was much more organic that once we learned about Joseph, as Frankie developed very differently, it became a like, of course he's neurodivergent. Yeah, of course he is. And it became almost by the time he finally did get diagnosed, because they both just got diagnosed eventually with as autistic at the end of last year. So by the time we got the diagnosis, it was a case of yeah, of course.
So it wasn't like a shock.
Yeah, you'd already been on that journey. And how did it feel? Because you talk about like that situation where they said, oh, if you thought your children might be gifted, and the idea of re-looking at your experience as a parent and your parenting. How did it feel, I guess, as you were seeking that diagnosis, as you went through that process, learning about autism in the way that it presented in your children and in Joseph in particular?
Yeah, the funny thing was that in Libellule, the centre in Lausanne, they did the ADOS test, which is a standard test diagnosing autism. And they told us that Joseph and Frankie weren't autistics. They said they scored 7 on this ADOS test. And then in Switzerland, their cutoff there was 15 at points. So they said a 0 would be, you know, 0 or 1 would be neurotypical. So there's something going on. So we kind of felt then for the years that we lived there, it was like, okay, well, they're not autistic, but there's something going on. So at least, you know, we can work to figure out what that is and what that, you know, is it sensory processing disorder? Is it a combination of lots of things? And again, not as informed as we are now. And, you know, I think to be honest, and again, not proud of this now, at the time we were like, okay, well, that's a relief. They're not autistic. Because it still felt like it was such an othering term. And as we all know now as parents of neurodivergent children or children with disabilities, it's like nothing changes the fact that they are our children. Nothing changes, you know, before diagnosis, after diagnosis, the same children are yours and you love them exactly. And they have all the same strengths and challenges and complexities and joy. And I hear, you know, when people say to me, oh, you know, we don't want to label them or we're a bit worried about it because they're doing fine. We're a bit worried about seeking. And I just go, but is going to change. They're still your child that you love. So it was only when we moved back to London 2 years later in 2021 that by luck, I got a CAMS appointment for Joseph. And the reason for that is he'd been diagnosed with ADHD towards the end of us being in Switzerland. And we had been open to medication for him. which was much easier to access in, under the Swiss health system. And the reason we were open to it was because, as I mentioned, Stu, their dad had been diagnosed with ADHD, and he had, along with his learning and then subsequent advocacy, he had himself had benefited a lot from medication. So we were open to it because we'd had that kind of experience. Moving back to London, going to the GP, it felt like, I don't know where to begin now accessing services. I don't know what, you know, I know nothing about this here. And so it's only because Joseph was on medication that it was like, oops, better get him seen quickly. So we saw a fantastic CAMHS psychiatrist. And when she first saw him, she said, I think this is more than ADHD. I think he's autistic also. And she was absolutely fantastic. That was, I suppose, a penny drop moment. And it was, I was waiting for somebody to say it, but because I'd been told all along, you know, no, not autistic, because he wasn't presenting in the typical way, as we, you know, now know, there's no.
Yeah.
But he seemed social. He made eye contact. Everything about him seemed normal, except for these sensory meltdowns, huge panic attacks, as I now know. You know, we used to call them rages or, you know, explosions, but yeah, panic attacks. So she saw what that was. And then from that moment, that made sense. And then we were firmly on the road to embracing autism and the complexities and gorgeous profiles of neurodiversity.
Yeah, we just gave a definition in the intro there, but can you just explain in kind of layman's terms what a PDA profile really is, and then what that, how does that impact your day-to-day with Joseph and your family?
PDA stands for pathological demand avoidance, and it's a term that is not very well known, even amongst, you know, CAMHS professional, medical professional, educational SEND professionals. People know very, very little about it. And I have the sense that it's the parents that are very much at the forefront of this, and they're very much educating. So pathological demand avoidant, our CAMHS professionals don't like to use the term, as many don't, because they don't like to use a phrase that pathologizes a child, particularly so young. And so what feels like it's a more appropriate phrase, and this is used by a lot of advocates, is pervasive desire for autonomy. And what it means is that children and young people or adults with PDA profile of autism present very differently. It's a disability of the nervous system, where demand, whether that be an external demand or an internal demand, even like being hungry, being cold, sets the nervous system into a kind of panic, into a fight, flight, freeze, or fawn state. And this is a cumulative thing. So it's a bit like, you know, we all experience this from time to time. We all get overwhelmed by, we've got too much going on, especially parents of children with disabilities. Yeah, kind of
all the time.
Get into the point where we're like fight or flight. So this basically sums up the disability and sums up the lifestyle. And it is incredibly difficult to live with. It's difficult to understand. But once you do understand it and once you get it, it's like the light bulb moment. So every parent of a PDA child knows their light bulb moment. The PDA Society is an amazing charity, and they've got the most brilliant website. It's just pdasociety.co.uk. And they describe, they in their fundraising, they say, give a family their light bulb moment. Everybody recognizes that phrase, because when you read the description of PDA, you go, that is my child.
What was your PDA light bulb moment?
It was actually on the PDA Society website when I looked at it and I read what is PDA. And I was like, that's it. Every little thing. So masking, very high masking, a lot of parents' experiences, children at school, they will be like, but they're fine at school. So a lot of parents we've all experienced a certain amount of gaslighting in that, you know, it's just you, basically, you know, they're just like that. Once they get to school, they're fine. Whereas what the reality is happening is that the child is masking at school, holding that anxiety in, And it's drip feeding. Every little demand is drip feeding into it until they're with their safe person, their caregiver, their parent, or in their home, and then it explodes. And I think a lot of us are familiar with that kind of the Coke bottle effect that it's called, where, you know, every little anxiety inducing moment is shaking the can or shaking the bottle, fizzy drink. And then when they see you as you're the safe person, the can is opened and it explodes out. So as I say, it's a cumulative thing. And also that's why it can sort of present differently in different places. So, you know, old school ADHD diagnosis would say, well, you can't have ADHD if it doesn't show up in school as well as in home. Well, you can, because you can't ask them.
What have you had to learn to do differently to parent Joseph?
The recommended approach, and we are so not experts in this, we constantly fall back into the traditional parenting paradigms that we've all learned and brought up with. But it's called low demand parenting. And it's basically, I mean, as far as the parent is concerned, you're reducing expectations, but you're taking that threat away. Because when they experience the anxiety, and that could just be a case of me, as I would very regularly have done, saying, come on, we've got to go. Come on, we've got to get to school. Quick on, shoes on, quick, everybody out. Have you brushed your teeth? No, no. That is just drop, anxiety, demand. And it basically triggers this panic attack where the thinking part of our brain in the front of our head, the frontal cortex, shuts down and the child trips into the amygdala at the back of the brain. Again, I'm not a scientist, but this is kind of what I've learned. And that's the fight or flight response. So it provokes this fight or flight. And then what I've recently learned is, so we would get the fight or flight at home. What I've recently learned is at school, my child would go into freeze mode, which is compliant, shut down.
Oh, like passive, frozen. Okay.
And that's only something that I've recently put two and two together on, because I remember in Switzerland, this teacher used to say he's very, he's timid. And I go, that's not my child. But either way, when they're in that part of the brain, they can't think, they can't learn, they can't listen. Mm. So no amount of trying to communicate to try and calm my child down, or to try and tell him off, or whatever it is that you might, you know, naturally do, doesn't work. So the only thing that works is to, I found when he was young, was to just open my arms, not touch him, but to just be there and to say, I know, I love you. I love you. I'm here. And it's so counterintuitive when you're out.
So hard.
Got another child with you. And then you've just got this judgment of people all around, because this child might be hitting, might be screaming, might be calling you names, might be punching a window, because they're in a panic attack. It's like a kind of a shell shock state. And as a parent, I know I have to respond to making him safe and making him feel safe. But I've only learned, you know, this is all the PDA Society learning is only been in the last, I'd say, 6 months. The thing that I've found has been the biggest support and biggest teachers have been other parents. So we've got a fantastic WhatsApp group of PDA parents who are themselves just like absolute brilliant fighters, campaigners, supporters. And, you know, just the fact that we can talk amongst each other without that kind of judgment that we so regularly experience.
How have you found family and friends outside of that community have been? Because you talk about kind of the judgment of strangers, but I know a lot of us feel, you know, B doesn't have a PDA profile of autism as far as I know, but there are bits of what you've described that resonate. And I think there is some overlap, certainly in terms of how her frustration and overwhelm comes out, and learning, relearning as a parent to be patient, because if I try and rush her with stuff or like use the stuff in my toolkit that is just inherently there because of the way I was raised, it just doesn't work. It has the opposite impact. I struggle sometimes, I would say, with like broader family members or friends of the family getting that actually this display of behavior in my child is not them misbehaving, and that I don't need to go stricter on that child or come down hard on them. Have you found that at all?
Yeah, I think all parents of neurodivergent children will have experienced that. And I think, I mean, my family personally have been incredibly supportive. My sister, my brother, and you know, my dad, he was with us at Christmas. He's in his 80s. And I mentioned that Frankie had just been recently diagnosed and we had his report. And my dad just sat there and read it, you know, kind of cover to cover, just quietly.
Fantastic.
We've got a book called it's on the kitchen table still at the moment. I think it's called PDA for Family Members. So in some ways, it's almost like if you take the responsibility from you as the parent to educate other family members and find resources that you can then give, like a book or a website or an article or whatever, and then let them learn that themselves. I think so many parents, even we ourselves, worry that are we doing the right thing. So the low demand approach is it's basically you want to reduce that anxiety so that they can have the best mental health, they can be their best selves, they can learn to their best ability. But no, low demand doesn't mean no demand. There are things that just are inescapable, you know, whether that's, you know, we have to eat, we have to, you know, classically with PDA children, for example, you know, they don't want to brush their teeth and we're all brought up with this sort of sanction reward system to a certain degree. And that is the everyday process at school. It's all about if you do this, then you can do that. But it's actually knowing that none of that serves us. Yes, there are natural consequences and we'll learn from our natural consequences. And I think it's just having faith that in the long term, I want my child to be in the best possible mental health that he can be. We know that from the PDA Society tell me that 70% of children with a PDA profile of autism are not in school because they're in burnout or they can't cope with school. So we're constantly dancing on the edge of that. At the moment, both of my children are at school, but we have a lot of emotional-based school avoidance. As long as I can keep demands low at home, then I can prioritize going to school. But getting into burnout is so common for children with PDA that where they just end up not being able to access the basic functions of life, not being able to leave their room, not being able to eat. As they get older, maybe, you know, self-harm, control in terms of eating disorders. So in a way, we don't have a choice. We're going to advocate to keep our children safe.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask, because it feels or it sounds quite like you have things in place to help you deal with your children and their needs, but are there things that you struggle with, or are there things that you have now learnt but that you would wish that you knew from the beginning, or that you would like to impart on somebody who's starting out in their journey?
Everything I wish I knew. I'm only at the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more to learn, obviously. I think since I've learned about low demand parenting, I do find that I get a little almost upset when I hear parents or teachers say to children or groups, come on, I told you not to do that. The shaming of children I find really, really difficult, and the blaming. And I've learned that I no longer do that. No matter how much I'm triggered, I'm not doing that. And having that taken away for all children, I just think would be such a benefit to mental health for every child as they grow.
Agree.
And the adults around them. Yeah. Like, I think some of what you've described, and as difficult as it is, it must have a positive impact on your anxiety levels as well to kind of take those moments.
I also try to learn from autistic adult communities online, so, you know, Facebook groups for autistic adults, because I think, you know, autistic adults have the lived experience to be our guides. You know, we know our children best, but I'm not neurodivergent and I would never purport to be an expert in any way. So my guides are the neurodivergent community online. So one of the things I've learned and I do struggle with is screen time. So I used to have just the biggest The biggest thing I would argue with Stu, my partner, about was, you know, screen time. So he's neurodivergent himself. He works in user experience design. So he's always been about screens and technology and an early adopter of everything. So he's constantly getting the kids like, you know, a Kindle or a, you know, Nintendo. And I've been that person who's like, they're only supposed to have 5 minutes a day. It's really bad for their brain. And so we'd have these constant res. And then I just figured out from reading these Facebook groups for PDA adults and imparting information or thoughts for parents, that this is our safe space. On screens, we can be, it's our way of regulating. Don't take it away from us. And it's a big no-no for parents to undermine that sort of advice. But it's still a balance. So last summer, we kind of said, okay, let's do this. Let's embrace low demand. Let them have their autonomy around screen time. Because really what PDA is about autonomy and equality. So this child has to feel like they have this autonomy. And God, we all want to feel that. You know, we just come from a society where children are worth less than adults in terms of our autonomy. So, screen time I still struggle with. So when Frankie, who's like completely 100% immersed in Pokemon every minute of the day, I find myself missing being able to have a conversation with him about something else that's not Pokemon. Because when he's not on his Nintendo, really focused on Pokemon, he wants to talk to me about it. And again, what I've learned is that this is his love language. The fact that he is sharing his huge life passion with me at the moment is his love language. But it's still hard. I still question myself, and Stu and I still will be like, oh, this is ridiculous. You know, come on, they've got to go into the bath and they won't get off the screen. And that's hard, and we don't know, but it's just a leap of faith.
Yeah. This type of parenting feels so similar to the concept of gentle parenting that's kind of going around, which I adopt because it's what works with Lua. Like, she can also become quite overwhelmed and angry, and because she's 8 but yet nonverbal, that lack of communication is such a massive part of her anxiety. So where previously, maybe when she was younger, and also I was still in that, you know, struggling to accept that she was disabled and that, you know, eventually she'll talk and she understands and blah, 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 all my own insecurities would play into the way that I parented her. But obviously, as you get older and wiser, you learn more about your child. So we now adopt kind of a more gentle approach where I allow her to fully express her emotions, but give her the grace to feel that and take time to immerse herself in that feel without being told off. You know, stop crying, get up, we need to go, hurry up, all of those things. But it's made such a massive impact into her. And I've noticed that, like, if she was to get upset about something, you know, mundane or whatever, and I'd be like, why are you crying? Like, I don't understand why you're crying. Like, stop it or whatever, which is awful, I know, but
we all did it. We were all brought up that way. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
so it's totally it. Kind of unlearning those patterns of parenting that we've had from our parents, from our grandparents, from our, you know, all of those things, which I feel that unless you have a child with a disability, you're so locked into that mentality of raising children. So in one way, I'm incredibly grateful to have a child with a disability because it shifted the way that I look at childhood development, and the impact that the way that you parent has on their development is like profound to me.
And if you're not exposed to the need to learn to parent that way, then you don't. Genuinely feel that if everybody was parented that way, this way, we would end up with a much kinder, more self-assured, more thoughtful generation in years to come. And I think, again, I see it with parents of PDA children, including myself. We worry that, oh God, if we take away all these demands, and again, it's low demand, not no demand, but if they don't have to go to school, if they don't, you know, if they don't have to eat at the table, if they don't have to conform to all of these societal norms, you know, how are they ever going to function as adults? Well, the answer is, this is their disability. And depending on how we accommodate their disability, that will have an impact on how they can be their best selves.
And advocate for what they need.
Totally, yeah. Exactly. And so, you know, it's just the sense. I mean, I read something really interesting recently. I think it was from Naomi Fisher, who does a lot of work around emotional-based school avoidance. And she said, I messed up this morning. I was 15 minutes late for a Zoom meeting and I was inappropriately dressed because I'd come straight from the gym. I apologized and we moved on. She said, I wasn't told off or shamed. I wasn't put in detention. I wasn't given a sanction. I didn't lose any of my free time because we're adults and that's the adult world. And in fact, if you think about that model, it's like, what are we supposed to be preparing our children for? We're supposed to be preparing them to respect other people, to respect their own feelings and emotions in order to be able to engage as an adult.
Exactly.
So true. And as you're talking, I'm reflecting on my neurotypical child as well. And just like, obviously things cross over in how we parent our children, because obviously you can't be completely different in your parenting approaches. But she conforms to the rules. And she's such a rigid rule follower. And my husband and I have given, she's about to finish primary school, and we've given her a challenge to get a demerit at school, because we're like, there must be something that you can do to, you know, that's justified, that questions where the rule is or overstepping the line. Please, for God's sake, please question, rebel, because I like, conversely, I sort of worry that she is way too deferential to like
societal expectations.
Yeah, exactly. And all these teachers, I mean, they're as wonderful as they are.
I think it's absolutely no chance and no coincidence that we are seeing so many comedians now being diagnosed and being open about their diagnosis of neurodiversity, whether that's ADHD or autism or both. I think there is something in that profile of being a rule breaker, being a somebody who wants to make other people laugh, who needs that sort of for maybe self-esteem. And, you know, the amount of comedians who say, I remember my earliest memory was making kids laugh at school. That's how I learned to be safe. Or my earliest memory was the sound of my mother laughing. And I see that with Joseph. I mean, I see it with both of them, but right from being a toddler, I saw that with Joseph. And I remember thinking, oh my God, geez, don't be, he's going to be a comedian. Oh no. And I look back and I go, like, you know, even if you think about Charlie Chaplin and people like that, I mean, so multi-talented, you know, not only an actor, but a, you know, a producer, a director, a composer, a musician, and had all of his sort of issues with his personal life, having come from a traumatic childhood. And I think we're now learning that there are crossovers in terms of how trauma, early childhood trauma, and neurodiversity show themselves. So there can be, you know, they're very, very similar. And then you look at everybody all the way through and you just kind of think, yep, absolutely, I can see it. And I love how it's being celebrated in comedy now. And I was a commissioning editor last, when we were recording Live at the Apollo, the season that's just gone out. And really, in every single show, it was a joy to see that, you know, there were not only neurodivergent comedians, but comedians who made it part of their act to talk about their neurodiversity and to advocate and to talk in a way that was funny, but also, you know, positive, affirming. There was a comedian who talked about his neurodivergent family and he said, you know, they didn't know when they were children. Nobody knew that they were neurodivergent, but his sister had, one sister had OCD and the other sister was epileptic. So, and they shared a room. So the sister with OCD every night had to go through a routine with the light switch where she's showing up.
Oh, geez.
And the other sister would just, they'd be, oh, there she goes. And and of course, and this was very, very funny, but I had to sort of find him afterwards to say, can I just check that this is true? Because, you know, we don't want to be laughing at people have OCD or any kind of neurodiversity. And he said, no, we're all neurodivergent. This is my absolute family. We didn't know. We did this every single day.
I love
Wow.
that. That's so
It's
hilarious.
not all tragedy. It's not all challenge. It is, as we all know, of parents of, you know, children with additional needs, it's joy. It is, you know, hilarious. And it is often, if you can't laugh, you know, you're just not going to.
What are you going to do, cry?
You're going to cry, yeah, exactly.
Well, if Joseph does want to become a comedian, I mean, oh, these people... he's got his foot through the door already.
Do whatever makes you happy. And, you know, there are a lot of comedians that are happy. I think there's a lot of comedians who are incredibly sensitive. I've noticed that a lot. You know, that level of sensitivity that goes with wanting to make people laugh and also just seeing the world in a different way. I think that's one of the brilliant things that comedians do. And then they lay it before us and we all go, oh, yeah. But there is a real inner sensory sensitive intelligence, I think, to be able to interpret the world and play it back to us.
See it in a different way. Yeah. I mean, talking of bringing your neurodiversity experience to work, can you tell us a bit about what you're doing or starting to do with this mission to get more parent carers into the workplace or back into the workplace or given the flexibility to make it work?
It's very early days. And in truth, I don't really know where I'm going with it. I'm just kind of making it up as I go.
Just going.
Yeah, one thing the other.
Just waving the flag for the parent carers.
Yeah. So I mentioned that we lived in Switzerland for 2 years, from 2019 to 2021, and I wasn't working and we had COVID and I was a full-time parent and I just kind of, you know, wiped children and floors and tables and bums and stuff. And I remember seeing the trail for the BAFTAs when I was there on the floor wiping something and going, oh, that used to be my life. And it felt so far from, you know, my fucking normal as it was. And when we got back, it felt like there was so much to do, so much to learn. There was no way I could work full time. And so there was no way really that I could return to my job. I was a full-time parent and there was so much advocacy. I was just learning about all those things that nobody tells you, like how to claim the disability living allowance, the fact that it'll take you 3 months to fill out the form because A, it takes so long, but B, it'll put you in such a negative space that you have to keep coming back to it. How to access support, all of those things just felt like that was a full-time job. And then finally, I was asked to return for a short period of time. I think it was for 4 months. And I was really lucky and I was really excited, but it was one of those cases of like, so could you come back next week? And I was only seeing, you know, I mentioned that I've got children with additional needs. Was, yeah, well, I don't really, you know, that needs a lot of support. So it's going to take me some time. And it's like, okay, so the week after next? So it was like, okay, right. We managed, I was working full time and it was extremely stressful. But I thought this is only for 4 months. I can do this for 4 months. By the time we got to 2 or 3 months in, I was at breaking point. It was my son's birthday. I was supposed to be on holiday and there were calls coming in about some issue with a program. And I just was like, I can't do this. I've got two autistic children. And just feeling that terrible stress and something was going to give and it was me. So I ended up saying, look, how about, I've only got a month left. How about if I do this month instead of doing full time, if I do it 3 days a week for 2 months? So I work exactly the same amount of days. You pay me the same overall. It's not costing you any more, but I will have that flexibility. And they were like, yeah, for sure that works. It worked for them. It worked for me. The other thing that I noticed going back was that I had changed so much in those few years that where I'd become a parent and learned what I'd learned, that I couldn't separate the work me from the parent advocate me. So I sort of started to think, oh my God, they're just going to think, here's this one who's constantly going on. Here she is banging on about neurodiversity again. Because every meeting I had, in order to explain where I'd been for like, you know, several years, I'd end up talking about my children being neurodivergent. And then at a certain point, I just thought, no, I can't separate this. This is me. And when people say, bring your whole self to work, this is who I am now. There is no way I'm going back to being just the person who commissions and execs programs. And, you know, I was never that good at separating myself from my job. It was always felt like that was, you know, I was a mixture of both.
Well, yeah, especially from when you started at 17, taking your personal experience. And of course you were going to bring your whole self into your job.
Yeah, and it felt like so many of my friends were colleagues. I socialized so much around work for years. And so I happened to, one of my first appointments when I went back was with, I was recommended to meet a disability-led independent production company, Rockerdale. And so I talked to Stu and Michelle from Rockerdale, and we talked about neurodiversity, and we talked about what kind of entertainment TV we could make around championing neurodiversity. And we had all kinds of crazy ideas. One thing that we really wanted to do, and I hope it does get done at some point, was House of Neurodivergent Comedians. So it was a kind of,
Wow.
so you can imagine, Big Brother, but like, you know, much more affirmative. And then the tasks would be things like they've got to do their tax return, or, you know, so yeah. So anyway, and of course, you know, this was like, how will I ever get this developed? I got 4 months back at work. This ain't going anywhere because, you know, we've got duty of care issues. We've got, you know, what would this look like? I've no idea. So I'm not getting anywhere with this, but we there must be something. And then Stu texted me late one night and went, I've just seen this French format. I'm going to send it to you. It is, I cannot unsee it. And it was a format called Les Papetins, and it was a group of French journalists, neurodivergent journalists from right across the neurodiversity spectrum. And they were pre-existing before the program was made. So this group of French filmmakers had come across them, and they thought, wouldn't it be brilliant if we got famous people interviewed by this group? So, and that's what they did. And so they made this fantastic show in French, and it was just so raw and so authentic. And they just had absolutely beautiful moments. And I thought, this feels like, you know, Gogglebox, the first time you see a different aspect of TV. And then I had this huge challenge to go, right, how am I going to get this commissioned? And I had various responses, and it was like, well, this sounds more like it's factual. And when you think, you know, budgets are really tight, we cannot commission everything. So I had to find, how can I best advocate? Because, and I had to keep going back and constantly tell myself, this is not just about me personally. I remember so, saying, this is going to change the playground forever. If we make this, this is going to change the playground. And I, and they're like, yeah, but we got to make entertainment programs. Like, it is entertaining. And then somebody said, well, what about, you know, I think we should just see neurodiversity in all of our content. And I'm like, we do see neurodiversity in all of our content, but people don't know that we're talking about neurodivergent people. So if we watch Live at the Apollo, for example, we have got lots of neurodiversity, but these are possibly people who mask, who succeed in society. What we don't see is people with learning difficulties. We don't, this is about the unseen. And so I managed to get some development funding, and Rockerdale, being brilliant as they were, went away, took that development funding. It coincided with the end of my 4 months. So my brilliant colleague, Clodagh, took it on because she was a fantastic supporter from the start. She had watched the Taster tape, and she said, this stayed with me. And I'm so pleased that yes, it got commissioned, and it's going out. The first one, the pilot episode's going out as part of Autism Acceptance Week on BBC One with Michael Sheen as a guest. And so it's probably on iPlayer at the moment, or it will be on iPlayer from April. And it is exactly that. It is neurodivergent, a fantastic group of neurodivergent British people interviewing Michael Sheen, and I just hope it goes from strength to strength.
I love the sound of that.
I can't wait to see it.
Had I not gone back with that lived experience, I wouldn't have been open to that idea or that conversation. So what I'm trying to do in terms of the space for people to work, BBC, and now it's, you know, a national, it's going to be law, but basically had a fantastic policy for people who work full time and also had caring responsibilities. It's things like you have additional leave for caring. If you need to go, people are very understanding. And there was a fantastic policy for full time workers who are carers. What I said is there's nothing for people who can't work full time. And so the research I've done amongst my immediate sort of peers is that, you know, we're pretty sure it predominantly affects women. I have so many women saying, you know, I have to be on hand because my child needs a life-saving injection, and I can get there to the school quicker than the paramedics can to deliver that. So I can only work from home, and I can only work flexibly, and I've had to start my own business to do that. And this is from somebody who also worked in TV. But another person, woman who said, I'm like, I was a really high achiever. I did an MA. I was, you know, very, very high earner. My child is not at school because they have PDA. I can't work. We're sliding into poverty. I'm renting out a room in my home, but we're not going to get remortgaged. And, you know, the carer's allowance is £74 a week. And she feels like she just thinks, I will never be able to return to work because I need to have that flexibility. So somewhere there has to be a balance. And again, we're talking about the unseen. If we could learn to do this during COVID, if we could learn that people could be on furlough, people could work from home, we could make television from people's homes, there has to be a way that we can say, we need the skill. All of these people are skills. That we're talking about people who've you know, brought so much to the workplace before they had children or caring responsibilities. It could be, you know, parents with Alzheimer's. It could be partners who are disabled. You know, the employers are losing out on all the skills, all this training, all this experience.
Not to mention the additional kind of, I guess, experience and skills that you build from in that carer capacity as well, which I think people often forget about.
So my first challenge is how to get the research on this so there's something really concrete to be able to say to employers. And I'm starting with the BBC and I'm starting with the film and TV and media industry. So I spoke to the fantastic director of Lenny Henry's Foundation, Lenny Henry Centre for Diversity and Inclusion in Birmingham earlier this week. And we talked about doing some research. And she said, as exactly as you have, about, you know, the lived experience that carers bring back to the workplace. And it was only then that I put two and two together about my lived experience and the fact that I was able to enable the development of that idea, which is now going to be on BBC One and BBC iPlayer, because of my lived experience. Had I not been a carer, that would have never come into play. So I think the challenge is to find... Nobody's going to do this out of the goodness of their heart. The employers have got enough to deal with. We've got a freelance crisis in this industry, which, you know, rightly is taking center stage. But if we can prove that there are so many benefits to the employers about looking at ring fencing roles that can be shared, ring fencing roles that can be flexible or working from home, then that has to be an advantage to everybody involved.
It's brilliant. I think it's a great idea. Can you come into my old industry and do it as well, please?
Start. Get my bit.
Yeah, no, it's so important. And I think, yes, that there's everything you just said about the lived experience that they then bring. But I think also there's like the actual just like skills that you develop as a parent carer, you know, having to rethink, see things differently, problem solve in a different way, advocate, manage like so many multiple stress. Things going on at once, and you know how like all of that, and I think for me the biggest thing, I went back to work after B, but then I ended up leaving again. I very much felt your description of I have these kids at home and I've got everything going on and something's got to give. In my case, I gave as well, but I definitely also had this kind of perspective going back that I couldn't unsee or unknow what I now knew in my experience. And I think that, like, as I call it, Rena has a bullshitometer that's like flashes quite a lot sometimes when I'm talking to her. But yeah, I feel like that having that kind of like perspective, when you bring that into the workplace, that is incredibly valuable too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, well, you know, we've all had these moments, I think, where people, colleagues might say really nicely, they like, oh, you know, have you had a lovely weekend with your boys? And you're like, no, I'm here for a rest. No. Or they'd be like, you know, oh, you're not working tomorrow. Oh, enjoy your day off. It's like, you know.
Oh, my God.
I think the biggest thing that would help, what I noticed with me personally, is like just the level of confidence that it builds being able to go back to work. Especially if personally I had to take 6 years off because it just would not work me going to work. Her needs were so high. Also, my confidence was knocked because my mental health was shot. But then once I was able to go back, the confidence in who I am away from mum/carer was profound, massive. And that would never happen had I not been able to go back to work. So not only are you getting women or people back into the workplace, but you're helping with their mental health, being able to go back to
and
work.
I think you're absolutely right. It's that because we are unseen as unpaid carers, as we're called, you know, we're on everything, unvalid. And then, so self-esteem absolutely goes. And that's why I referred to, you know, I just seem to spend my life wiping, because, you know, it's like, that sort of feels like that's your worth. And nobody thanks you, as we all know, you know. So, and then I remember when I went back to work, I got like quite a few like, oh, we should meet for a coffee. Oh, and I'm like, I'm the same person I was last week. But you, the validation that you get brings that self-confidence back, and that self-confidence, you take it home and you are happier and calmer, and because you don't feel so put upon. And I think, you know, I've got a brilliant friend who's Irish like me, and she talked about this kind of Irish mammy trope being brittle. And I think that's something that I really identified, particularly in Switzerland when I was a, you know, 24/7 carer, that sense of being brittle is that you're fragile, but you're also sharp, and it's not a nice way to be, you know, because
you're overstressed, overstimulated, overtouched, over the situation. It's difficult. I was the same for a very long time.
Being back in the workplace to a certain extent, you know, where you can accommodate working, it just helps us to soften again, to flower, to be seen in a different way.
Mm.
So to end, Suzanne, why don't you tell us what your fucking normal is?
Well, fucking normal can be anything on any given day. But I thought about when we first moved back from Switzerland and came back to our home in Stoke Newington, the kids started school again here. Well, they started school for the first time here. We had gone from, as I said, we lived on a vineyard, so there weren't really any shops around. There was one lady used to sell ice creams for a couple of months in the summer, and that was it in Switzerland. In London, we were back to this like highly sensory, mad environment where there were sweets and there was an ice cream shop and there was comics and there was everything just in that few minutes of walking to school and back. So we quickly learned, Frankie was, I think, 5 and Joseph was 6 or 7, that, you know, it needed both of us to do the school run, because they were at that age where if they wanted to run into a shop, they were going to run across the road in front of 4 lanes of traffic, no matter what you did. And this was before we understood PDA and before we understood low demand parenting. And we were in a panic ourselves all the time. So at one point, they both decided to run into the road, and it was a one-way street with 4 lanes of traffic and a bus lane. And so the only thing we could do was to sort of grab them. So we sort of grabbed them both from behind, and we backed into the only place we could sit down while they kicked and screamed. And there was a pub doorway. There we were at the pub on the corner across the road from school with all the other families happily making their way home from school. And we're there holding our children as they kick and scream in the doorway of the pub, sat on the step of the pub. And at this point, Joseph does the only thing in his power to equalize. And that's what PDA children do. If they feel that you've taken away their autonomy, they will equalize to get on the same level as you. And at this point, and thankfully yet, he still doesn't know any serious swear words, because our PDA children do like swearing. So he took the only word that he knew and he was going to use for the maximum impact. And you know, when they're little and the doctors say, oh, you should give them the, you know, the proper name for the body.
Correct term. Yeah.
And you think, as soon as you've done that, you think, well, that was a mistake. Anyway, so there we are. They're kicking. Every parent's going, hello, are you okay? Yeah, we're fine. Thanks. Bye. And next thing, Joseph just throws his head back, shouts out at the top of his voice, vagina, vagina, vagina. And every parent and every child and every toddler and every baby in a pram that passed by sort of looked at us, and they just, that's like, okay, kept walking. So yes, vagina, shouting his voice as a form of protest and a manner to equalize. I think there's a good chance he will be a comedian. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. At least you didn't go, do you mean vulva or vagina?
Labia.
Yeah, exactly.
So your fucking normal is having your kid scream vagina to equalize the power imbalance.
Outside a pub, sat on the step of a pub at school home time, yeah.
I love that.
Perfect.
Oh,
Perfect.
Suzanne, thank you so much for being a guest on the pod. We've really enjoyed having you.
Absolutely lovely. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk.
Yeah, I've loved it. I've learned so much, actually. I'm going to be really thinking about my parenting. in a good way, in a positive way.
Agree. Oh, amazing.
Thank you so much.
Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Fucking Normal podcast. We love making this podcast.
Yes, we do.
We are part of a much bigger team, almost exclusively all parents of disabled children. And our goal is to reach as many people as possible and create a community of support for parents and carers who share our experiences.
So if you've liked what you've heard, please like and subscribe so that we can reach out to more people. You can find more information on this and other episodes at fuckingnormalpodcast.com. That's fkingnormalpodcast.com. You can join us on Facebook and on Instagram at fuckingnormal_podcast. That's fkingnormal_podcast. You can get all the links and more information in the show notes below.
So thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Wake me up.